You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to SpyCast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, SpyCast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about SpyCast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make SpyCast better, and you can help.
This is Chris Costa, Executive Director, International Spy Museum. Today we're joined on the phone by recently retired General Joseph Votel. General Votel last served as Commander of the United States Central Command, where he was responsible for U.S. and coalition military operations in the Middle East, Levant, and Central and South Asia. General Votel had a distinguished 39-year U.S. Army career, serving much of that time in special operations. We will post the rest of your bio for our listeners on our website. Sir, good afternoon. It's great to see you.
Hey, Chris, how are you? It's great to be with you, and it's wonderful to be on SpyCast.
Well, thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it. It's a privilege to have you on. I look forward to this. So again, thank you for joining us today. Before we get started in earnest, I thought it was important to note for our listeners that I was very fortunate to have served under you while you were the Commander, U.S. Special Operations Command, and Commander of Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC. And I had several opportunities to see you before I left my last job in government at the White House in 2018. As a preface, I'd like to begin the conversation with the earliest days of the Trump administration. In February 2017, I traveled to Tampa to your headquarters at Central Command with POTUS and a fairly large delegation from the White House when you, General Thomas, and General Dunford, Chairman of the JCS, all had an opportunity to discuss accelerating the ISIS campaign. And you had an opportunity to engage POTUS at that time. And I certainly was a backseater in that, not at the table. From my perspective, counterterrorism priorities defined the earliest months of the new administration. By February 2017, the media had reported on a palpable threat stream from the Middle East. You oversaw an operation against Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And you were really responsible for the Defeat ISIS campaign. To sum up, there was a lot of pressure on you and U.S. Central Command. Can you take us back to that time? What were you thinking? What was going through your mind?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Chris. Well, first of all, we were very excited to host the president and his team so early on after his inauguration. That was a really seminal event for us and a great opportunity to host the president down there. We're very, very glad he chose to come to CENTCOM first. But I guess I would share just a few comments with you about where my head was at this particular time. First off, at this point in the campaign here in early 2017, the plan was in place, and we were beginning to see success in the overall military campaign. Now, it certainly wasn't irreversible at this point. There had been a series of ground actions, both in Iraq and Syria, that were moving in the direction that we wanted to go, and we had a very incremental campaign at that particular point. And when I say incremental, it means we focused on specific activities, specific battles, specific areas we wanted to focus, and that was kind of our approach to build some momentum into this. So we were still at this point really trying to gain momentum, although we knew we were on the right approach with the overall campaign plan. Our partners in particular were beginning to hit their stride. In Iraq, we had accomplished a fair amount of rebuilding of the Iraqi army that was so beaten down in 2014, had now come back. And while there was still a ways to go, they were actually racking up some victories. But of course, it wasn't just the Iraqi forces. There was the militia, there was the CT elements, and the Ministry of Interior, federal police type organizations that were also part of this. So a key piece that we were focused on at this time with the Iraqis was helping them with unity of effort. We had seen some real problems with this in places like Fallujah. And where I was in terms of the partner development with the Iraqis was, how do we get them to more of a unity of effort, recognizing they're never going to be a coherent joint force like we would think of. So that was where we were. Over in Syria with the Syrian Democratic Forces, we were dealing with areas like Manbij, which were, coming to a conclusion here. And we were now moving out of the traditional Kurdish areas more and more into the traditional Arab areas. So the Arab component of the Syrian Democratic Forces was actually becoming more important at this particular point. And what we were trying to do was kind of foster that and keep that going and continue to bring on Arab militias to support General Mazlum and his YPG forces as they continued to march against ISIS. And of course, we were continuing to deal with some of the other features of the battlefield, concerns from Turkey and Russian the support to the regime. So these were all kind of key things. I think the third point that I'd make to you about this is that the nature of the campaign, the fight, was actually beginning to change at this time. As I mentioned to you, we had started this out in a very incremental fashion. But as we closed on to places like Mosul, it became very apparent that we were now entering a different phase of the operation where it was going to be long, sustained campaigns. And what that meant was we would have to rely on leaders at the lower levels to make decisions, where in the past we had kept some of that at a higher level. In the beginning, a lot of it came back to CENTCOM, and then we started to move it down. But by this time, by early 2017, we were gaining momentum. We knew that our success was dependent upon getting decision making to the right level, and we also knew that there had to be greater fluidity in the between the fights in Iraq and Syria. As you will recall, we had a separate set of, before the Trump administration came in, we actually had some different authorities in Iraq than we had in Syria, yet we're fighting a contiguous enemy here. And so I think one of the very, very helpful things that took place early on here was, through the Department of Defense, ultimately with the National Security Council and the president, was making sure that we got the authorities that we needed to make this a fluid operation between Iraq and Syria. And I think that was a really important piece. But my ability to move resources where I needed them to be without always going back and asking for a National Security Council decision was very, very important. And I know people talk about this, about increasing the authorities. This is one of the examples here. It was very, very helpful to us, and it came at the right time in the campaign. And then I would say the last thing that I was really thinking about at this point was coalition coherence. We had a growing coalition. They are very important to us. They brought unique capabilities. Nobody's going to bring as much to this as the United States does, but they brought important capabilities. So we were very keen at this time to get some other coalition partners on the ground with us in Syria, and we were working with the Norwegians and with the French and with some others here to get this going, and that was very, very important for us as well. So that coalition coherence was an important aspect of it.
Yeah, a lot of times, well, first of all, that's a great lay down. A lot of times people forget that coalition consisted of 72 or 73 countries, and it's important because of partners were tremendously critical, I think, to the success of the operation. And just jumping forward, and then we'll come back a little bit. By the time you retired, ISIS and the physical caliphate was mostly gone. AQAP to this day are reportedly on the ropes, and it appears that wide-scale troop withdrawals are on the horizon in Afghanistan. So in short, really the Middle East landscape has already changed significantly when you reflect back to 2017. So I'd like to shift a little bit to the Middle East and take on something we're all dealing with, and that is COVID-19. How do you think the pandemic is going to affect the Middle East?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's going to divert attention away from the longstanding issues that we have been dealing with in places like the Middle East. And I think the big concern that I have for something like COVID or pandemic, and certainly in this part of the world, is that it has the potential to spiral and to make these deep underlying issues even worse. So you think about the large groups of refugees, you think about the disenfranchised population, you think about the disparity between wealth and poverty here. You think about corrupt governance, the inability of governance to extend out to the people. All of this becomes even worse in this situation. And of course, it creates the environment and the disruptive, chaotic environment that groups like ISIS and others really thrive upon. It was interesting, and I'm sure you've seen this, but there's a report the other day that I saw of an interview of an ISIS family member, a wife, actually referring to COVID as a soldier of Allah. That's the way they look at this. Yeah. And they're not concerned about themselves or the spread of the virus. They are looking at this as a way to enable their objectives and to move forward. And I think this should be of great concern for us, and certainly is to me.
I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, I've been talking about that in some of our programs, this very notion that it's apocalyptic, so it supports their worldview, ISIS worldview. So it is something that we have to watch. And plus, more broadly, I think the U.S. could be potentially distracted. I'd like to move on to Syria. Last fall, I think October, al-Baghdadi was killed. By all accounts, it was a brilliant U.S. raid operation. I want to know what you think of the impact on ISIS in terms of the future health of ISIS. You think it matters?
Yeah. No. Well, first off, I would agree with you, Chris. It was a brilliant military operation, and it's something we've become used to from our military and certainly from our special operations forces of being able to put together complex, high risk missions like this and execute them with such precision, accuracy, and effectiveness. And again, you have to give a lot of credit to the people on the ground, but there are others that contributed to this as well, intelligence community that helps with this. And of course, we had partners, and it's been reported that the Iraqis helped us with some of the intelligence for this. So we have to give credit where credit is due in this important operation. But, I think removing leadership is a critically important and necessary part of our CT operations. While it is necessary, it's not wholly sufficient. It is important to remember that actors like al-Baghdadi or bin Laden or others that we have removed over, and any number of the ISIS leaders removed, have always had plans in place for continuation of operations and continuation of leadership. So it's absolutely critical that as we move forward, even with this very successful operation, that we continue to keep pressure on these networks and on the leadership that does it. When you look back to the very effective approach that we took against AQI, al-Qaeda in Iraq, back in the 2006, 7, 8, 9 timeframe, this was the model right here. It was constant pressure and removing leaders and disrupting their system as much as you can. And soon you have people doing two or three or four different things, and you just overwhelm them with your own momentum in this. And that's the important thing I think we have to keep in terms of this. Removing people like Baghdadi is important. It's not only symbolic, it disrupts the ideology a little bit. He certainly was a central figure in all of this. He was an important unifying leader for ISIS. And so, these are always important operations, and they're critical to doing this, but they're not sufficient in and of themselves to actually accomplish our objectives. We have to keep the pressure going on this.
So that's a great segue to the next part of the discussion. What is the impact of pulling out U.S. military forces for all intents and purposes out of Syria, a much smaller footprint? I know you wrote some excellent pieces along with Elizabeth Dent in The Atlantic. If you can reflect back on some of your thoughts at the time and where you are today, I'd be interested to know, going forward, where does that leave us? Clearly, Turkey is fully engaged now. Idlib is still contested, I think. But so you have Al-Qaeda there, and you have remnants of ISIS. They're going to crop up. There's reporting that I've seen open source that there are clandestine cells. They're keeping their heads down, but it's not over. And what does that pullout really mean going forward?
Yeah, thanks. So, first off, I do have to acknowledge, as many of our listeners probably understand, that the Kurds, the Syrian Democratic Forces, the Kurdish portion of that, and the Arabs who made that up, were very, very good and reliable partners for us. Clearly, the Kurds provided the backbone, the leadership of all of this, and were extraordinarily reliable partners for us. And I'm glad that despite some of our policy decisions we made here, we have been able to maintain some type of relationship with them and maintain contact, and in some cases actually be co-located with them. This, I think, is very, very important. What I learned about get to the question here in just a moment, but what I learned about the SDF and the Kurds and Syrian Kurds in particular is they were experts at balancing relationships with multiple actors. Even during the time that and I interacted with General Mazlum and over the course of 3 years, basically, it was always very evident to me, and he was quite transparent in this, that he was talking to everybody. He talked to his, maybe not him directly, but his organization talked to the regime. They talked to the Russians. They talked to the Iranians. So they're expert at balancing relationships with multiple partners. And right now, I think my assessment is that balance seems to be holding right now. I have maintained a contact with General Mazlum. I haven't talked to him in a couple months here. I'm hope to look to talk with him again soon. But, in my last discussion with him, he seemed to think things are kind of balanced on the ground. I think the challenge here is that While that's good that things are kind of balanced and maybe have stabilized to some aspect and the violence is down a little bit, it really is not addressing the long-term issues here. The long-term issues are, recovery and reconstruction in this part of the country. The yeah. long-term issue associated with, a political level of political inclusion of the Kurds into the Syrian regime. And of course, there's the issue with Turkey that goes along with that. And then, of course, the long-term prospects for peace. So, I think these things still remain. Yeah, I think it's important, and I'm sure our listeners understand all this, is that, campaigns can't just have military components. They have to have political and diplomatic and, develop humanitarian aspects of all of them. And what I'm most concerned about is that while we've had a good military outcome here from our campaign against the caliphate, we have not yet found an effective political model to begin to address these underlying issues. And there's several things going on. There's the effort goes on with Iran and Turkey and Russia through the Astana process, and then there's a kind of a UN process that is kind of moving forward there. But I'm fearful that we don't have the political clout because of how we are there right now to actually see that area through to some kind of political solution. And I think it's not necessarily because we don't have the diplomatic heft, if you will, meaning the people that can do this. I think it's the reduction in our presence, our limited scale of operations on the ground, I think have impacted our ability to influence the situation. So I think the task going forward is to try to find a constructive way to advance the you know, a peace process here. And I think it's got to be a process through the United Nations. And I know that's a difficult prospect, but all of these are going to be difficult. And the United Nations offers the best opportunity, I think, to add legitimacy to a solution that takes place here and then perhaps opens up economic aid and other things that have to come to Syria to help stabilize this and make sure that it doesn't become, you know, the sucking chest wound and the source of instability for the Levant and much less the broader region. And so, you know, I think the best thing we can do is, you know, is continue to ensure our influence, certainly in places like Iraq, and then look at how we help bolster some of the legitimate peace process efforts that are trying to gain some traction here in Syria. And I think this is going to really be a difficult and lengthy process for us.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
Yeah, it certainly will be a long haul. So you explicitly in the two articles you made two very important points. One, you mentioned the importance of intelligence gathering and the impact of pulling forces out and how it could affect intelligence gathering. Realize there are sensitivities there, but if you want to offer some insights on that. And secondly, perhaps more importantly, really is the detainee issue, which I've been concerned about, not only the radicalization of families, but also just the hardcore fighters that are being detained. So could you talk a little bit about those two areas?
Yeah, Elizabeth Dent, my colleague from the Middle East Institute, and I have both wrote about this on a couple of occasions here. And, you know, I think the concern that we were trying to highlight in this is that a policy decision of this nature, I think, does call into question our commitment and staying power and our commitment to our long-term partners or to our partners. I'm not sure we'd characterize them as long-term, but as to our partners. You know, it was difficult for me to overcome the sacrifice that the Syrian Democratic Forces made on behalf of the coalition, 11,000 killed and wounded in the course of the campaign, you know, versus our killed and wounded here. I mean, it was not in any kind of equal comparison, certainly. And so there was a significant commitment that they made. And along the way, we had promised them, we had told them that we are going to see you through with this. That had been our policy. And so an abrupt change like this, I think, does upset this. And it really undermines, I think, the relationships. Now, what's happened in as the situation has played out, the Kurds have proved to be more resilient, I think, in their relationship. Right. So we have been able to maintain a relationship, and you know, I can't make a judgment on their level of trust or anything else, but they're with our, they're co-located with our forces on the ground in some areas here. And we continue to cooperate and collaborate and do other things like we had done. So that's good. But I think the idea here is that, you know, we have to be careful of undermining long-term relationships and sending the message to others that we don't value this. I think it's important for our listeners here and others to recognize that back in 2014, when we went through a lengthy political process to decide if we were going to go back into Iraq when ISIS took over, you know, and we made the decision. The way we did that was we used personal relationships between special operations officers and Iraqi Kurdish partners that they had had during our last piece. We had some relationships and things going on at the embassy, but to get into the actual campaign and begin doing things like that, we really had to rely on those relationships. And I had a front row seat to seeing this because I was the JSOC commander at the time. And I recall the reporting that we got back here as our officers, a couple of officers went in on the ground and started, we picked up just like that, where these relationships had dropped off in 2011. And that's, to me, is testament to the importance and strength of relationships. And that's what we're trying to preserve long term. And of course, as you talked about the refugee situation, the encampments and other things on the ground here, these are long term issues that are going to have to be addressed, and they're going to have to be addressed internationally. There are, you know, detainment locations that are being guarded by the Syrian Democratic Forces of the Kurds, Syrian Kurds, that where there are fighters. There are fighters going on the ground. Of course, there are camps like Al-Hal, where we've got, you know, literally thousands of family members. Yeah. And these aren't just family members that have been displaced here. These are radicalized family members in many places. You know, it was instructive to all of us that as this fight against the caliphate concluded in March of 2019, as we were loading family members on the trucks and moving them to places like Al-Hal to get them out of the area, they were singing ISIS fight songs. They were as radicalized and as aggressive in their rhetoric at that time as we would have ever seen from ISIS. And so these people represent the true believers. And when you put them in camps like this, your long-term refugee camps in the Middle East are a problem. And so this has to be addressed. And I think it's going to require a significant international effort to ultimately resolve.
I couldn't agree with you more. I made that point to many foreign partners that it is not exclusively a U.S. problem. It is a world problem, and there are future would-be terrorists that are in those camps now. And to your point, they're radicalizing. So those are great points. If you can kind of in brief just offer your perspectives, what are our objectives going forward regarding, and this is a loaded question, regarding Syria, Iraq, and Iran? If you had to boil it down to a few key points, what does the United States need out of the region right now?
Well, I think one of the countries most important to us here is Iraq. And I think one of our objectives here ought to be to continue to support the sovereignty of Iraq help them. You know, they live in a difficult neighborhood. They've got a 1400 kilometer border with Iran. That's not going to change. That's a fact. It's going to be present now and well into the future for a long time, and they'll probably never change. So we got to be pragmatic about this, but we also have to support Iraq for Iraqis and help them withstand the influence that comes from Iran, or withstand or deal with the problems they have with Shia militia groups that are more beholden to Iran than they are to the government of Iraq. And this will take patience and it'll take persistence on our part, but it's worthwhile because this is a great way to hedge against Iraq. A stable Iraq at this critical nexus is really important for us. So I think that's our first objective. The second thing I think is we just got to have a sustainable approach to our long-term military relationship. And that'll largely be through security cooperation. And we've got to We've got to make sure that we have organized ourselves on the ground for this, and that we can continue to stay engaged. We don't necessarily need to have large forces on the ground for a long period of time, but what we do need to have is a very capable and a well-resourced security cooperation program.
So relatedly, you talked about, and you've written about, gray zone conflicts. And I think Syria has become the model of what you've written about, this idea of a battle for influence in the region. You had Russians on the ground, you had Turks on the ground, you had ISIS, you have regime forces, counter-regime forces, Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, Iranian proxies, and other militia groups, all playing for influence on the ground. What are your thoughts on this battle for influence? Did we cede ground in this important conflict, or am I making too much of it? I know we've talked about this before, because I think no one has articulated gray zone conflict better than you have. You kind of made that term a term of art. So if you could talk a little bit about gray zone, what it means to you, and what it means on the ground in Syria, really in the region.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I think you kind of hit it on the head here. Yeah, one of the things we have to do in the Middle East is we have to compete. Now, you know, our national military strategy is focused on competitive advantage against great powers like China in particular, and Russia to some extent. But a key part of this is making sure that we compete in other areas against the great powers. We don't give up our influence in these areas. And that's what competition in the gray zone means in this particular area. And we have unfortunately made some decisions in the past that have really made this very, very complicated. Our decision to step away so completely in 2011 from Iraq, we saw what happened there, and we failed to consolidate on this great victory that we had had, up to that point, and we saw the aspects of that, and we created a situation, you know, that got worse, and that others allowed to step into this. Our decision to limit our influence and limit the amount of terrain that we are, at least our partners had control over in Syria with our great assistance, I think has ceded a little bit of the initiative in that regard in Syria. And I think we have removed ourselves from really being a credible partner here who can help drive the long-term solution. So, you know, this is, I think, what kind of concerns me about this. So in the Middle East, we have to compete. We have to compete in these areas right here. And again, competing doesn't necessarily mean large military forces. In some cases, it doesn't mean military forces at all. What we have to do is we have to look at how we balance our complete, you know, elements of power here, whether it is military, whether it's economic, whether it is business, whether it is informational, our diplomacy, our political power in this area, and we have to maintain influence. You know, one of the things that the political advisors that I've had working for me at SOCOM and at CENTCOM have always reminded me is that, you know, it has been a longstanding precept of our foreign policy that we wouldn't let another foreign power control this area. It would not be supportive of our national interests. And so we've had a longstanding strategy that has done this. We balanced relationships between Iran and Saudi Arabia for a long time, and we've continued to be an actor in the region. So I think we have to compete, and we have to stay focused on being an influential partner in this part of the world.
So I'm going to digress for a second to go back to the question. I should have come back to it on intelligence again, because I think that's related. Without a big footprint on the ground, we still have capabilities, intelligence capabilities. And you wrote about the loss of some of those capabilities by pulling forces out. And since this is a broader battle for influence, and there's other concerns, we haven't even mentioned Israel, their concern with proxies on the ground in Syria, leaving from Lebanon, the Israelis are making their presence known, at least kinetically, in places like Syria. So if you could talk a little bit about the loss of intelligence, or do you think that might be overblown?
Yeah, well, I think this is an aspect, but let me just say this, is that, you know, the intelligence community is one of the jewels in our crown here, of how we protect ourselves and preserve our interests, and that's important, and we're better today than we were, you know, a year ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago. We're better at this. But there are going to be challenges as we as we continue to move forward. And when we step back from partners, we lose the inherent human capability that comes along with all of this. The long-term relationships that we develop are things that don't just serve us for the operations we're doing today, but they are things that help us in the long term. And that's how we use economy of force here. How we, you know, a real tool for us to limit our physical presence on the ground is to have a great network of partners that are feeding us information that are trustworthy to us and help us understand the situation. So when we have to respond, we can, or if we can assist them in responding, we can do that as well. So I really view this as a way of offsetting risk here and allowing us to concentrate in other areas where we actually need more military capability in the Pacific or in Europe or wherever it happens to be to support our interests. But intelligence really, I think, helps offset some of the requirements for those large forces.
And for years, you were a major consumer of intelligence, of course, and at Central Command, intelligence was very important coming from the JIC, right? Joint Intelligence Center. Can you just, you offered some perspective on your view of the U.S. intelligence community. Is there anything else you want to add up from your
vantage? Again, I'm very complimentary of it, and I'm this is an area that I have a lot of certainly continuing interest in. But there are going to be challenges. There are going to be challenges beyond just what we've already talked about. I think if you look at the emerging technology that is now coming on, whether it's 5G or whether it's artificial intelligence or machine learning or these type of things, I think these are going to pose unique challenges for us in the long term, and they're going to impact our ability to collect and understand, collect intelligence and understand what's happening out there. The proliferation of data right now, getting our own arms around large data and how we mine that. I mean, the solutions, and the understanding more and more is appearing in open source data type things, and we need to make sure that we understand that as well. And of course, we have other third party actors out here that continue to be challenged. And I'm not just talking about terrorists. I'm talking about hackers. I'm talking about others that are stepping into this very complex environment here and beginning to operate, and they're going to have an influence on security in the long term. And we really have to understand these kinds of things. And so, as good as the intelligence community is today, they're going to continue to be challenged by these types of issues in the future to continue to remain at the very capable level that they are.
So last regional question, Afghanistan, do you think the talks are going to continue to go well? Are you optimistic for success in those talks, and how is it going to play out with the Taliban? What's your take on?
Yeah, to answer your question directly, I mean, I think it's possible to be hopeful and pragmatic at the same time. This is going right now about like we expected it to be. It's going to be very complex between the government of Afghanistan and the Taliban, and I think we expected that complex, slow. It's going to be Afghan hard the whole way through all of this. But the important point, I think, here is the process is joined, and progress, even small, incrementally small progress is progress in Afghanistan. And it's really what we've been fighting for, frankly, to get to this point where we can do this. And this, and I think going forward, it's going to require our continued support and influence and the hand-holding and other things along the way to make sure these parties continue to move forward. And that's just what this is going to take. And it's going to be hard the whole time. It's going to hurt the whole time, but this is what is required for us to see this through to a solution. And you know, ultimately, you know, again, I'm always hopeful for the people of Afghanistan. Ultimately, it's going to take some compromise here on the parts of the principal parties, the Taliban and the government of Afghanistan. But you know, strong partners like the United States and other of our other NATO partners have got to continue to support this process.
So more generally, you have had a significant impact on counterterrorism and strategic, and you've been retired for a little bit. What are your reflections? I mean, what other challenges lie ahead from your optic now?
Well, that's a great question. You know, it's interesting. Today's date is the 24th of April, and it was just 40 years ago today that probably many of listeners to this and people involved in the communities in which you and I have been experienced Operation Eagle Claw, which, of course, was our effort to go in and recover our hostages in Iran. And what we, you know, obviously it was a failure from a military standpoint, and it was a failure strategically, and it led to a lot of investigations, the Holloway Commission, and that ultimately directly that studied this, that ultimately fed the Goldwater-Nichols Act and led to the formation of SOCOM and the very unique capabilities, and today has resulted in unquestionably the best special operations force ever, not just in our own history, but ever. And that capability. So, you know, what I think about today as I look at this is making sure that we don't take things for granted. You know, a lesson out of Desert Storm, out of Eagle Claw here is, you know, you can't confuse enthusiasm with capability. It means you have to invest, and you always have to take this very, very seriously. We always have to be looking at the situations that we find ourselves in, adapting and changing, and you know, being what the nation needs us to be. This is not a disappearing threat, and as much as we would like it to be, it's not going away, and we will continue to contend with this for the foreseeable future. And so we have to maintain a sustainable approach to combating terrorism going forward. In my view, it's better to deal with it away than it is on our own shores. And that's going to require that people are going to have to be deployed, and we're going to have to develop partners, and we're going to have to make sure we got programs in place to support them and be able to, and we're going to have to focus money and intelligence and other resources onto it to make sure that we keep it at bay and keep it under an acceptable level of control. So I think these are going to continue to be challenges to us because we're going to be distracted by other things. We're already being distracted by COVID. We're going to be, you know, we're necessarily have to deal with great power competition here. These are going to drive resources, and they're going to try to take things away as opposed to adding things. But we've got to figure out smart ways to keep the focus on this particular threat, even recognizing that there are greater threats out there. So we're going to have to continue to deal with this.
Well, it's great to hear your insights on national security broadly and regionally focused as well. So talk, you're still going to be in a position to really influence thinking going forward. You are president and CEO of BENS, Business Executives for National Security. Can you talk a little bit about your new role, your transition, how that's gone? Of course, you're working from home right now. We're anxious to see you in D.C. around town when this thing ends. But how's it going?
It's going good, and I'm very, very proud to be part of this organization, BENS, Business Executives for National Security, a national nonprofit comprised of senior business people from across our nation who volunteer their time, treasure, and talent to provide expertise, lessons learned to our national security community, and do it all pro bono. And they don't sell anything. They don't They don't take any money. They just do this because they are concerned about the country. I think the important thing that that I really like about this is it really highlights the importance of this nexus between prosperity and security. This is so important for us in the long term. And you know, where we have strong security, we have great opportunities for prosperity. Where we have prosperous countries and we have business relationships, we generally have good security. So these things go hand in hand, and it's really, really important. And I'm hopeful that as the president and CEO at Benz, that I'm able to continue to use this great organization as a kind of a neutral, incredible platform to bring these communities together, the national security community and the business community, to help address, you know, issues of national concern. So I'm very, very proud to be associated with the organization.
Well, that's exciting to hear. And we're glad, as I said, we'll see you around DC, and I hope to get you to the Spy Museum as soon as we're reopened, and we will reopen. I'm curious if you have anything else you'd like to add. Is there anything I should have asked? Any other reflections before I wrap up with two quick questions?
I think we've covered quite a bit there, Chris, and I think you've got most of my thoughts on these items here right now.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm curious what you're reading right now. I always like to ask senior leaders that question, and any book recommendations, and what are you digging into right now?
Yes, thanks. That's a great question. Right now I'm reading a book called Mega Communities. And it is by several authors. The leading one is a gentleman by the name of Mark Gerentscher, who happens to be a Benz member, frankly. But this is a book, and it talks about how leaders of government, business, and nonprofits kind of how they come together to take on global challenges. You know, certainly we're seeing some of this right now in the pandemic, and that's what kind of got me interested in reading about this. But it's a pretty good read, and I would certainly commend it to your listeners. I would also share one other great book that I've read here lately, a book called Range by a gentleman by the name of David Epstein. And what it basically this book talks about is why generalists, people that are, you know, general experts and, you know, have a lot of knowledge and experience in a variety of areas, do well in this very specialized world. It's really, really interesting reading, and they use a lot of sports analogies and in some cases some military analogies here to talk about why people with broad-based experience, broadly developed skills, seem to thrive in a world where we have a lot of specialized capabilities, specialized focus areas here. And I think it's a pretty good book, I think, to read. It helps, I think, you know, understand people and how they think about things and how we develop kind of the next generation of leadership.
We'll put that on our reading list to be sure. So, sir, that's a wrap. We covered a lot of ground. I want to thank you for your long and distinguished service to the nation. It was a privilege to work under you, serve with you, and I'm very grateful for you taking the time to share your insights with us today.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be with you and wonderful to be on SpyCast.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit. If you want to donate to the museum, or if you're local and want to volunteer at the museum, please visit our website at spymuseum.org for more information.